jai. Namacharya Chilharidas Thakur ki jai. Prems to the Lord Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktivinoda ki jai.
Jai.
Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shanikunda Radha Kunda Jiri Govardhan ki jai. Vrindavan Dham ki jai. Mathura Dham ki jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dham ki jai. Jagannath Puri Dham ki jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi ki jai. Bhakti Devi ki jai. Tulsi Maharani ki jai. Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki jai. Gaura Pranamaya. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Shiva Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivinoda Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvasesa Sinivadi Paskatyade Satarane. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Vanchakalpa Tudhishtaki Basindhi Evacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namah. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So it is July 27th, 2022 in Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 2, Text 4. This is the activities of Maharaj Agnidra. So this is in prose. Sacha tad ashramo pavana ati raman iyam vividha nibida vitapi 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 Nichara Samslista Purata Lataruda Stala Vigangama Mitunai Prochyamana Shrutibi Pratibod Yamana Shaila Kukuta Karandava Kalaham Sadibir Vichitram Upa Kujitat Mala Jalasaya Kamalakshara Upababrahma. Just one second, I gotta get something. Okay, word for word. Sa.
Sa.
Si, Purvachiti.
Si, Purvachiti.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also. Also.
Tat.
Tat.
Of Maharaj Agnidra. Ashrama.
Ashrama.
Of the place of meditation.
Of the place of meditation.
Upavanam.
Upavanam.
The park.
The park.
Ati.
Ati.
Very.
Very.
Ramaniyam.
Ramaniyam.
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Vividha. Varieties of.
Varieties of.
Nibida.
Nibida.
Dense.
Dense.
Vitapi.
Vitapi.
Trees.
Trees.
Vitapa.
Vitapa.
Of branches and twigs.
Of branches and twigs.
Nikara.
Nikara.
Masses.
Masses.
Samshlishta.
Samshishta.
Attached.
Attached.
Purata.
Purata.
Golden.
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 Lata.
Lata.
With creepers. With creepers.
With creepers.
Creepers.
Aruda.
Aruda.
Going high. Stala Vigangana.
Stala
Vigangana.
Of Landbergs.
Of Landbergs.
Maitunai.
Maitunai.
With pears.
With pears.
Prokyamana.
Prokyamana.
Vibrating.
Vibrating.
Shrutibhi.
Shrutibhi.
Pleasing sounds.
Pleasing sounds.
Pratibodhyamana.
Pratibodhyamana.
Responding.
Responding.
Shalila Kukuta.
Shalila
Kukuta.
Waterfowl.
Waterfowl.
Karandiva.
Karandiva.
Ducks.
Ducks.
Palahamsa.
Palahamsa.
With various kinds of swans.
With various kinds of swans.
Adibihi.
Adibihi.
And so on.
And so on.
Vichitram.
Vichitram.
Variegated.
Variegated.
Upakujita.
Upakujita.
Resounding with the vibration. Amala.
Amala.
Clear.
Clear.
Jala Ashaya.
Jala Ashaya.
In the lake.
In the lake.
Kamala Akara.
Kamala Akara.
The source of lotus flowers.
The source of lotus flowers.
Upababrahma. Began to walk in.
Began to walk.
Muted. Unmuted.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. The Apsara sent by Lord Brahma began strolling in a beautiful park near the place where the king was meditating and worshipping. The park was beautiful because of its dense green foliage and golden creepers. There were pairs of varied birds, such as peacocks, and in a lake there were ducks and swans, all vibrating very sweet sounds. Thus the park was magnificently beautiful because of the foliage, the clear water, the lotus flowers, and the sweet singing of various kinds of birds. Very sattvic atmosphere. So going on to text 5, we'll just read the translation and the purport. As Purvachiti passed by on the road in a very beautiful style and mood of her own, the pleasing ornaments on her ankles tinkled with her every step. Although Prince Agnidra was controlling his senses, practicing yoga with half-open eyes, he could see her with his lotus-like eyes, and when he heard the sweet tinkling of her bangles, he opened his eyes slightly more and could see that she was just nearby. So this is kind of a recurring theme that Prabhupada is going to mention here in the purport. It is said that yogis always think of the Supreme Personality of Godhead within their heart. Dhanavastita tad gatena manasa pasyantiyam yogina. Bhagavatam 12.13.1. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is always observed by yogis who practice controlling the venomous senses. As recommended in Bhagavad Gita, yogis should practice sampreksha nasikagram, keeping their eyes half open. If the eyes are closed completely, there will be a tendency to sleep. So-called yogis sometimes practice a fashionable form of yoga by closing their eyes and meditating, but we have actually seen such so-called yogis sleeping and snoring while meditating. This is not the practice of yoga. To actually practice yoga, one should keep his eyes half open and gaze at the tip of his nose. Although Agnidra, the son of Priyavata, was practicing mystic yoga and trying to control his senses, the tinkling sound of Purvachiti's ankle bells disturbed his practice. Yoga Indriya Samyama. Actual yoga practice means controlling the senses. One must practice mystic yoga to control the senses, but the sense control of a devotee who fully engages in the service of the Lord with his purified senses, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam, Majulila 19170, can never be disturbed. Srila Prabodhananda Sarasvati therefore stated, Durantendriya Kalasarpa Patali Protkata Damstra Yate Chaitanya Chandramrita 5. Prabhupada quotes this a lot. The practice of yoga is undoubtedly good because it controls the senses, which are like venomous serpents. When one engages in devotional service, however, completely employing all the activities of the senses in the service of the Lord, the venomous quality of the senses is completely nullified. It is explained that a serpent is to be feared because of its poison fangs. But if those fangs are broken, the serpent, although it seems fearsome, is not at all dangerous. Devotees, therefore, may see hundreds and thousands of beautiful women with fascinating bodily movements and gestures, but not be allured, whereas such women would make ordinary yogis fall. Even the advanced yogi Visvamrita broke his mystic practice to unite with Menaka and beget a child known as Shakuntala. The practice of mystic yoga, therefore, is not sufficiently strong to control the senses. Another example is Prince Agnidra, whose attention was drawn to the movements of Purvachiti the Apsara, simply because he heard the tinkling of her ankle bells. In the same way that Vishwamitra Muni was attracted by the tinkling bangles of Menaka, Prince Agnidra, upon hearing the tinkling bangles of Purvachiti, immediately opened his eyes to see her beautiful movements as she walked. The prince was also very handsome. As described herein, his eyes were just like the buds of lotus flowers. As he opened his lotus-like eyes, he could immediately see that the Apsara was present by his side. The Apsara sent by Lord Brahma began strolling in a beautiful park near the place where the king was meditating and worshipping. The park was beautiful because of its dense foliage and golden creepers. There were pairs of varied birds, such as peacocks, and in a lake there were ducks and swans, all vibrating very sweet sounds. Thus the park was magnificently beautiful because of the foliage, the clear water, the lotus flowers, and the sweet singing of various kinds of birds. As Purvachiti passed by on the road in a very beautiful style and mood of her own, the pleasing ornaments on her ankles tinkled with her every step. Although Prince Agnidra was controlling his senses, practicing yoga with half-open eyes, he could see her with his lotus-like eyes, and when he heard the sweet tinkling of her bangles, he opened his eyes slightly more and could see that she was just nearby. So in this instance, although Prabhupada mentions Vishramrita and Menaka and Shakuntala in the purport, Agnidra wasn't exactly being distracted from his meditation, because his whole purpose of meditation was to get a demigoddess wife so he could have good children and go to the planets of the ancestors, Pitriloka. That was his purpose. We find that the yoga system is not always engaged in for the purpose of devotional service. We find even demons, like Hiranyakashipu, is engaging in meditation in order to get boons of being able to be a big controller. Ravana engaged in meditation. So there are many persons. Of course, Agnidra is a very exaltedly great personality. He's a very pious personality. He's not demoniac, but he's a pious materialist. So he's engaging in yoga for the purpose of getting a good position within this world. That is his purpose. So in this case, Purvachiti is the answer to his meditation. It's what he's meditating on. It's just like these modern people who are involved in these pseudo-spiritual practices in order to control the world. You know, they have this philosophy that you meditate on something and that's what you get, right? You engage and you live a sattvic life and you meditate on what you want. You know, you want a beautiful woman or a handsome man, or you want a new sports car, or you want, you know, your business to be successful. And so you engage in a sattvic life and you engage in meditation and you make that your sankalpa. You make that your goal of your meditation. You make that the goal of your practice. And then, of course, Eko Bahunam Yo Vidadati Kama, the Lord within the heart, understanding the desires of the living entity fulfills their desires. Of course, if you're very pious, like Agnidra, the son of Priyavrata, so Lord Brahma gets directly involved, and he sends the lady right to your ashram. Now, there she is. You know, you meditate on her, and there she is. So if someone's not quite that pious, it's not necessarily that they're meditating on their new sports car, and they open their eyes, and there's their sports car. But at least Krishna will give them intelligence, matasmatirgyanam pohanam cha, how to achieve their sports car. So that's, of course, not the purpose of the yoga system. It's not the purpose of religion. But many people take up some religious practice for that kind of purpose. I mean, there's a whole Christian movement, at least in the United States, called the prosperity doctrine, which is very similar, where there's, you know, Christian ministers who teach that the purpose of Christianity is to become prosperous in this world, and that if you worship Jesus and etc. and you meditate on becoming wealthy, then you become wealthy. And of course, these people are generally not even engaged in some bona fide process. Most of them are just abject con men and cheaters. And they'll say, you know, if you really want to get wealthy, then send me money and just see how wealthy I am by worshiping Jesus. Of course, their wealth is all coming from stealing from their followers. But the actual purpose of religion is not to use God to get things in this world, or to use the process of Dharma to get things in this world and to become happier in this world. I mean, it does work like that, whether it's karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, or even bhakti yoga. There's at least one place where Prabhupada says that if you're chanting Hare Krishna with offenses, then you'll achieve things of this world. There's one purport in the Chaitanya Charitamrita where Prabhupada talks about one of his godbrothers who wanted to have power and control. And the reason that he joined the Gaudiya Math, the reason that he became a disciple of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati, was he wanted power and control. Prabhupada said he wanted the buildings. And he said, and so Krishna gave him the buildings. He said, but he didn't give him the mission. So it's also a fact, you know, if you're chanting Hare Krishna and you're worshipping Tulsi and you're worshipping the deity and you're taking prasadam with a view, you know, that I want to marry a beautiful apsara, I want to go to some higher planet. So Krishna may fulfill that also. Of course, sometimes it says that Krishna doesn't give the devotees anything that's going to entangle them, and that Krishna fulfills the desires of the devotees in such a way that they will cease to have those desires. But that, of course, depends on one being an actual devotee and not simply using the process for their own purposes. So those sort of injunctions apply, or those sort of statements apply to the mixed devotee. I was talking to someone today who said, you know, I read in the scripture that I shouldn't be wanting liberation, but I do want liberation. And I said, well, just be honest about it. Just say, Krishna, I'm very sorry. I know I should want pure devotional service, but unfortunately I also want liberation. And I want to come to the point where I only want to please you. So in those sort of instances, like Dhruva Maharaj, who actually wanted to please the Lord but also wanted a kingdom, or Gajendra, who wanted to please the Lord but also wanted liberation, those sort of Sakkama devotees, their bhakti does purify them of these desires. But if somebody, you know, ostensibly takes up the practice of bhakti not at all to try to develop devotion, but just to try to get something in this world, then they may just get something in this world. And that's true, again, with all of the forms of yoga, that all of the forms of yoga can be used like that. It's a misuse of them, but they can be employed like that. And therefore, we find even demons who take up, as I was saying, various processes of yoga in order to enjoy the world very expertly. I mean, really, that's a lot more intelligent than people trying to enjoy the world in a sinful way, which is what we see in our modern society in 2022. We see that the main thrust of the leaders of society to enjoy and control the world is by damaging the world. You know, they're not performing any sort of process of yoga. They're just raping the earth, and they're exploiting the animals, and they're exploiting the other human beings of the planet, and so forth. And this way, trying to become very powerful. And they're destroying everything. You know, it's hard to find such a beautiful garden as described here, because these demons, they've destroyed the earth. Even to have enough water, you know, beautiful birds, peacocks here, and ducks, and swans, and cranes, and flowers, and fruits, and these descriptions throughout the Bhagavatam, it's hard to find places like that. And, you know, even the beautiful places of the world. There was a song, I think by Joni Mitchell when I was young, called "They Paved Paradise and Put Up a Parking Lot." I think it was actually about Hawaii. And so this is actually what's going on, you know, that it's becoming more and more difficult to find places of natural beauty. So this is they've created a dystopia instead of a utopia. So what is the actual purpose of yoga? Now, the actual purpose of yoga is to attain loving service to the Supreme Lord. That's the purpose, to be meditating on the Lord, not meditating on some demigoddess. I mean, again, the reason Agnidra opened his eyes when he saw Purvachiti is she was who he was calling for. She wasn't exactly a distraction. She was his sankalpa. In the case of Vishvamrita, Shakuntala was a distraction. So the idea, like Prabhupada told us when we met with him in 1974, is to know God and to love him. That's the purpose of the different kinds of yoga. Now, as a side effect, one's senses become controlled. If the purpose of yoga is to control the senses, that's a materialistic purpose. I mean, it's very easy to understand why we want to control the senses. So let's look at that. I think it's, again, pretty easy to understand. Why do we want to control our senses? And let's look at how sense control is achieved in each of the four kinds of yogas: karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, and bhakti yoga. Keeping in mind that sense control is a side effect, it's a symptom of progress in yoga, it is not the purpose. So why do we want to control the senses? Well, we all have experience that uncontrolled senses leads to misery. If I eat too much, I get a stomach ache. My stomach hurts if I eat too much. So, you know, I take that second piece of cheesecake. Oh, it tastes so good. And then I take that third piece of cheesecake. Oh, that tastes so good. And then my stomach is full and bloated, and I feel miserable for the next 3 hours. So I had some cheesecake enjoyment for, what was it, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then I'm miserable for hours. And if I have a habit of eating three pieces of cheesecake, then I get fat. And if I get fat, then I'm always uncomfortable, my body's always too big, it's uncomfortable to sit, it's uncomfortable to walk, it's hard to get up, it's hard to move, and then I can get so many diseases, you know, heart problems and diabetes and so many things. So it's a very simple example that everybody has experience with of why we want to control our senses. You know, or if you're eating too many sweets, you get tooth decay. We experience it in our own lives, and we experience it by other people's lives. Or people who can't control their sexual urges. And, you know, they have so many illicit relationships. And then they get various sexually transmitted diseases. And they get emotionally devastated at all the, you know, turbulence and the breakup or the cheating and the infidelity. And then there's children that they don't want to take care of. And the children don't turn out very good because they're not loved and they're not wanted. And So again, everybody knows what is the result of uncontrolled senses. Or if somebody, you know, they want to have a lot of money and so they cut corners with ethics and they do things that are not quite right just to get a lot of money. And then if it's really wrong, they get in trouble with the law, you know, or they'll get fired from their job or something like that, or uncontrolled anger, right? When we get very angry and if we say something that it really shouldn't be said, and it can harm a relationship for years. It can permanently harm a relationship. I mean, just yesterday I was thinking of something that someone said to me a couple years ago, and I was realizing, wow, ever since that person said that thing to me, I don't trust them. It's like that, you know, there's been a permanent break in my trust with that person because of one moment of uncontrolled senses. So, you know, we all experience this sort of thing. Or somebody in a fit of anger, they break something. Or sometimes they hurt another person. Or sometimes they kill another person in anger. Right? So we all know this. We all know that if we don't control our anger, we don't control our speech, we don't control our eating, we don't control our sexual desires, that the result is miserable. And so every society, every human society has some provision for controlling the senses. I mean, it's one of the things that human children are taught. You know, I often take care of my great-grandchildren, so they're 2 years old and 4 years old, and they will try taking the toys that the other child is playing with. You know, and we'll have to say, you know, Abhimanyu, you can't take your brother's toy. You have to ask him for it. He has to give it to you if he wants to give it to you. You can't just take it. And this sort of training has to be repeated over and over and over and over and over as a child is growing up, by the parents, by the school. So we have these sort of systems for controlling the senses. And generally the systems in human society are, you know, we have the training of the parents, we have the social pressure of what to do to be accepted in society. Of course, we have laws and so forth, and we have so many stories of people who control their senses and people who don't control their senses and what happens. Yes? So again, keeping in mind that sense control is a side effect and not the purpose of yoga. And this is very important because just controlling the senses allows you to enjoy the material world better. That's one of those poison in the beginning and nectar at the end kind of things. So it's poison at the beginning that you only eat one piece of cheesecake, or maybe you don't eat any cheesecake. And then the nectar at the end is that you feel full of energy and your digestion is happy and you're at a good weight for yourself and you're healthy, etc., etc. So you actually get more pleasure by controlling your senses than by letting your senses have free rein. So if that's simply the purpose, the purpose is I'm going to control my senses to be happier in the world, which is very, very true. That's not the purpose of religion at all. You know, Prabhupada would say, like, you're in a cage, you're in a prison, and just being in the minimal security prison for the white-collar criminals, you know, you're still in a prison. So, you know, I mean, better to be in a minimum security prison for white-collar criminals than to be in solitary confinement in the maximum security prison. But whether it's golden shackles or iron shackles, what is Prabhupada saying? The first canto, the need of the soul is to be free. All right, so again, let's please keep that in mind. That's not the goal of religion. So let's look at karma yoga. How does a person control their senses with karma yoga? Well, karma yoga means you do whatever you would have done as in the realm of karma. And the realm of karma means basically varnashram. So if you're young, you go to school, you're in the prime of life, you have a family, middle age, you're retired, and end of life, you're renounced. And when you're in the prime of life with the family, you do some work that's according to your nature, and you make sure that that work is honest work, and you do it to glorify God. So that is karma. And karma yoga means that you don't try to enjoy the fruits of your work. Like most people, they study so that they'll get good grades and people will say how smart they are. Maybe they'll get some awards. And they marry so they can enjoy the love of their spouse and the love of their children and their own home and their own car and their own bank account. And they retire so that they can, you know, enjoy taking a cruise around the world. I mean, this is why people do these things, and people get a career so they can enjoy feeling that they've contributed to society and they've made a contribution to the good of the world, they've made their mark on the world, and so that they're doing something that fits with them. And they're doing it for their own fruit. They're trying to enjoy the fruit of what they do. So karma yoga is, I do all the same things, but I do all the same things for the purpose of liberation. I do all the same things for the purpose of purification. Now, the main difference between karma yoga and bhakti yoga is in karma yoga, I keep my identification with the world. So in karma yoga, it's I am a kshatriya, and I'm doing this for purification. I am being kshatriya, grahastha kshatriya, for my purification. In bhakti yoga, it's I'm a soul who's acting as a grahastha kshatriya to please the Lord. So that is the difference between karma yoga and bhakti yoga. And Krishna explains very nicely in the Bhagavad Gita, that in the 12th chapter, that the fruit of renunciation is peace. That when you give up trying to enjoy what you're doing, you become peaceful. So that's sense control. Sense control is you become peaceful. You're not working to try to get something. You're not working to try to renounce something. You're doing things because it ought to be done. It's where you belong. I have the nature of a Shudra, therefore I am working as a Shudra. I have the nature at this point as of a sannyasi, therefore I am working as a sannyasi. I am doing things because it's what I ought to do. I'm a heart muscle, therefore I'm in the heart. And I'm doing this just for the purpose of universal harmony and my own purification. And that way one gives up desires to enjoy and one controls one's senses, and one attains peace. And one can say also that the sense control in karma yoga is very much like the sense control in karma, except it has a different purpose. That the sense control is, this is my duty and this is not my duty. You know, I'm a grahastha, therefore I have this spouse, and I don't have a different spouse, so therefore I can enjoy sex with my spouse and not with somebody else. I'm following according to the rules of being pious. The motive is different. This is my boundary. I'm a Vaishya, therefore I can act in these ways, and I don't act in the ways of a Brahmana or a Kshatriya or a Shudra. So that is how one becomes sense-controlled. Now, in Gyan Yoga, it's very interesting. In Gyan Yoga, one becomes sense-controlled by analyzing what is me and what is not me. So some thoughts enter into the mind. I want that cheesecake. And one says, that's not me. That's the mind. Some desire enters into the body. You know, I want to yell at that person, or I want to approach that person romantically. And one says, oh, look at that funny desire. That's not me. It's just the body. It's not truth. It's not truth. Now, a lot of the religions today are definitely preaching karma kanda, and some are preaching karma yoga, but there's also becoming more and more popular, and I wouldn't say religion so much, I'd say spiritual groups or quasi-spiritual groups that are preaching gyan yoga. And many, they're extremely popular, that one puts one's consciousness in such a way that one recognizes that I am the observer of the desires, the thoughts, and the feelings that enter into my body, but they are not me. I am a soul, and therefore I don't need to act on any of them. I don't need to act on them, and nor do I need to repress them. I simply observe them. Now, of course, this aspect of Gyan Yoga is also in a way a part of Bhakti Yoga, just like Karma Yoga. If you're saying, I'm doing what I would do anyway in the world, but I'm doing it for purification, becomes, I'm doing what I would do anywhere in the world, but I'm doing it to please Krishna as a soul. So that's what distinguishes it. And in Gyan Yoga, instead of I'm doing this for freedom, it becomes I'm doing this to please Krishna. So that point is made very nicely in Bhagavad Gita 2.64, which I talk about quite a lot. How in Bhagavad Gita 2.62 and 2.63, Krishna talks about the process by which the senses go out of control. That the mind contemplates something. Oh, another piece of cheesecake. A beautiful woman, a handsome man, some more money. Getting even with that person who bothered me. Yelling at that person. Whatever it is that the mind's contemplating. And then as the mind contemplates it, it gets attached. Yes, if I just yell at that person, I'll be happy. If I just go and tell that person what a terrible person they are, I'll be happy. If I just eat that other piece of cheesecake, I'll be happy. And then that turns into lust, which is, I must do this. I have to do this. And I don't care what the consequences are. If I yell at that person and because of that my relationship breaks, I don't care. I have to do it. If I eat another piece of cheesecake and I gained another pound, I have to do it. If I go for that romantic partner and I disturb my marriage and I disturb my community, it doesn't matter, I have to do it. That's lust. Lust means that I no longer care about the consequences of my activities. I become kind of blind. And of course, lust leads to anger because the result of uncontrolled senses is always suffering. And so one becomes angry at the suffering, which is a natural result. And that anger, it bewilders our intelligence, one loses one's memory of what does it say in the Shastra, etc. So the cure for uncontrolled senses Krishna gives in the next verse, 64, where he says, give up attachment and aversion, externally control your senses, and you will get Bhagavat Prasad. So the external control of the senses is like what's done in Karma Yoga. That one works for the benefit of the Lord instead of for one's own benefit. And the being free from attachment and aversion is what's done in Gyan Yoga. The difference is that in Bhakti Yoga, that even though Krishna in different parts of the Gita, one can say that he's describing the different types of yoga, ultimately he's describing Bhakti, as Srila Prabhupada so much points out in his purports. And therefore, ultimately, he's describing how all these different types of yoga function within Bhakti. So in bhakti, and I've seen that within the practitioners of bhakti, this aspect of Gyan Yoga is not often understood and not often practiced, although it is part of our practice of sadhana. In fact, it's one of the items in the angas of bhakti, I think it's 16, given by Srila Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, not to be affected by happiness and distress. And of course, Krishna speaks about this in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is in the Bhakti Yoga section, verses 13 through 20. Not to distinguish friends, enemy, neutral, happiness, distress, fame, infamy, honor, dishonor, heat, cold, etc., etc. To have this kind of neutrality. Now, how is this done in Bhakti Yoga? It's done in Bhakti Yoga by focusing on who am I? I am a soul. My enjoyment is within. So just the pure Gyan Yogis, they're just simply saying, I am a soul, my enjoyment is within. My enjoyment is not this thought, not this feeling, not this desire. It is not me. Therefore, I neither need to enjoy it nor renounce it. I can just observe it. And the next step that's taken in bhakti is not just I'm a soul, but I'm a servant of Krishna. And I do have an enjoyable relationship with Krishna. All right, what about in Gyan Yoga, which is what Agnidra is practicing here? He's practicing Gyan Yoga. So Gyan Yoga is a very interesting way of controlling the senses. It's a mechanical way. It's using the human body, using the movement of the life airs in the human body, using the energy flow, like the chakras in the body, using certain types of breathing, and of course also living a pious life, as all of the types of yoga require a pious life. but controlling the body mechanically, changing the way the body is breathing, changing the way the body is sitting, changing the subtle movements within the body so that the senses become calm. And in that state, one does the same thing that one does in Gyan Yoga. One doesn't follow the various desires, thoughts, and feelings that enter and leave the body. But there's a next step that one is focusing on the super soul. So in Gyan Yoga, it's often impersonal, just I am Brahman. In Karma Yoga, it's often I am part of the universal body of God. Here I have my place as part of the universal form of the Lord. In Gyan Yoga, it's I am a soul and Brahman. And in Gyan Yoga, it's I am connected with the Paramatma. But it is a mechanical process. It's a mechanical process. The human body, particularly, is designed in such a way that it can be controlled through certain types of posture and breathing and ways of dealing with the mind. So this is a little higher level, because one is not just saying, I am the soul, but one is engaging the soul in some positive activity of meditating on the super soul. Now, the problem, though, is that this in and of itself does not produce rasa. It does not produce a taste. So it produces some bliss, certainly. I mean, Brahman realization also produces some bliss. Even understanding that I have my role in the universal body produces a lot more happiness than a gross materialist. Just like Sattvagun produces much more happiness than Rajagun, and Rajagun produces much more happiness than Tamagun. So there is happiness progressively in each of these yogas, but none of them fully satisfy the desire of the soul. So in bhakti yoga, the senses can be controlled because the indulgence of the senses in material things becomes completely laughable compared to the happiness one is experiencing within. And for this, I thought we would turn to Bhagavad Gita 2:70, a very famous verse, of course. The translation is, "A person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires." So that sounds like all the kinds of yoga are doing this. So all the kinds of yoga, though in Karma Yoga, one is like, that desire is not for me. That's an improper desire for me, according to my varna and ashram. Therefore, I will not satisfy it. In Gyan Yoga, it's, that desire is of the body and the mind, and I am not it, and therefore I will just observe it and be neutral to it. In Dhyan Yoga, it's again, that desire is not me, it's of the body and mind, and I will turn my attention instead to the Paramatma. Let's look at this purport. "Although the vast ocean is always filled with water, it is always, especially during the rainy season, being filled with much more water. But the ocean remains the same, steady. It is not agitated, nor does it cross beyond the limit of its brink. That is also true of a person fixed in Krishna consciousness." Now here's where we come to what I think is very important and often not understood. In fact, I had one sannyasi recently argue with me on this point, and I said, hey, it's in Bhagavad Gita 2:70, it's in Bhagavad Gita 14:22-25 purport. So here, getting back to the purport, "As long as one has the material body, the demands of the body for sense gratification will continue. Sometimes people think, when I become an advanced devotee, the desires will go away. The thoughts, the feelings, the desires will go away. That is not true." I'm going to read this sentence again. "As long as one has the material body, the demands of the body for sense gratification will continue. Going on, "The devotee, however, is not disturbed by such desires because of his fullness." I'm going to skip a few things. "Desires may come to him like the waters of the rivers that flow into the ocean, but he is steadying his activities and he is not even slightly disturbed by desires for sense gratification. That is the proof of a Krishna conscious man, one who has lost all inclinations for material sense gratification, although the desires are present. So the rivers that enter into the ocean, of course, there was a nice place on the Big Island, we would see a river going into the ocean. There is a point at which you can distinguish river and ocean, and there's a point at which the river simply becomes the ocean and one can no longer distinguish river and ocean. So in a similar way, the thoughts, emotions, and desires that enter into the body and mind, there's a point at which one can distinguish and say, oh, there's a thought, there's an emotion, there's a desire. And then after a while, if unattended to, they simply dissipate. They simply dissipate. And then some other thought, feeling, and desire will come. And at first it can be distinguished, and then gradually it dissipates. So the jnani practices, not me, not me. I am a soul, I am a soul. The dhyan yogi practices, not me. Oh, there is the super soul, there is the super soul. And for the devotee is experiencing the real rasa of which these thoughts, feelings, and desires are simply a reflection. And who would be interested in a reflection when you have the reality? Right? If you actually have something enjoyable, why would you be interested in a semblance of that enjoyment? It doesn't make sense. You know, if I can actually go swimming in some beautiful pond in some gorgeous park, and, you know, like is described here for Agnidra, why would I want to see a movie of somebody else doing it? I mean, why wouldn't I want to enjoy the real thing? It would be, you know, if someone says, hey, stop watching your movie about enjoying with a beautiful woman in a beautiful park and come enjoy with a real beautiful woman in a real beautiful park. So everybody would go for the, assuming everybody would go for the real thing. So when we're actually enjoying all these rasas with Krishna, then the material semblance of the rasas that only leads to misery, it has no attraction. As Prabhupada says, the devotee has their fullness. And only in bhakti, yadyatma supersedati, does one get this total fullness, because then one is engaged with Bhagavan. And of course the devotee uses aspects of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana yoga in bhakti. One does one's duties to please the Lord. In order to please the Lord, one doesn't identify with one's thoughts and feelings and of the body, and one does meditate on the Lord, except not meditating on the super soul. One meditates on Bhagavan Sri Krishna. One meditates on Krishna and Vrindavan, as Mahaprabhu explained. Externally appear, you know, like a sadhaka, and internally be absorbed in meditating on Krishna and Vrindavan. All right, so the objection is going to be there that, well, we see a lot of bhakti yogis who fail to control the senses. I mean, come on. We all see this. Even if we have perfectly controlled our senses, we see a lot of other people in bhakti yoga, sincere people in bhakti yoga, who have failed to control their senses in various ways, especially sexually, which is what's being brought up here. And we may have that experience in our own life. You know, maybe we've had experience with difficulty controlling our sexual desires, or maybe even on a small level that, you know, we eat too many pieces of cheesecake, or, you know, we read or watch things that we shouldn't do, or we get angry when we shouldn't, or in some way, we may experience that we also struggle to control our senses. And we may say, well, I don't know if what Prabhupada's saying here is true, because I'm in bhakti yoga, and I see all these other people in bhakti yoga, and, you know, we're not doing much better than Agnidra here, and Vishramrita. You know, we're kind of in the same boat. And so sometimes people will conclude, well, then a person's not really in bhakti yoga. And we have this, you know, unfortunate conclusion sometimes that you'll see some bhakti yogi that fails to control their senses, and especially if it's a sexual thing. And then people will say, oh, they're not really a devotee. Because the symptom of a devotee is that they'll be sense controlled. And of course the answer is obvious, that there's a difference between a sadhaka and a siddha. that a sadhaka devotee may sometimes have difficulty controlling their senses. Otherwise, Krishna wouldn't say apichet sucharacharo. He wouldn't say that even if my devotee does something abominable, they're still saintly. He's not talking about the siddhas. I mean, you could say in rasa that the gopis, you know, going to Krishna in the middle of the night is abominable or something like that. But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about sadhakas who are in the process of tasting the real rasa. And in the while they're working on that, may sometimes not feel fully fulfilled, and therefore may sometimes try to taste the material rasa because that's their habit. They're accustomed to trying to get enjoyment through material rasa, and so out of habit, if they don't feel fully satisfied with spiritual rasa, they may look for the material rasa. But that will be gone very soon. It's not that consequential. Obviously, one should not be a pretender. One should not be, as we talked about in the beginning, people taking out religion just to get something material. But there's a difference between being wicked and being weak and being in the process. It is expected that students make mistakes. That's expected. Imagine a student in school who never makes any mistakes. Or Prabhupada talks about, and I give this analogy all the time, the child learning how to walk. This is his example that he gives in the Nectar Devotion, that sadhana bhakti engages the walking process just like a little baby practices to walk. And it's not something artificial. It's not something that, like ballet, is something artificial, or gymnastics. Not like that. But walking is natural. A newborn baby, one of the things they test right after birth is whether or not a newborn baby has a walking propensity. They hold the baby upright and see if the child puts one foot after another on a surface. It's part of what's called the Apgar score. So walking is natural. But just because walking is natural doesn't mean, you know, we're not like giraffes, we human beings. You know, giraffe, the child is born, the baby giraffe is born, the mother is standing up to give birth, and the baby giraffe falls out of the mother onto the ground and very quickly has to be able to get up and run with the herd, or it's going to be dead. So human babies don't do that, right? It's quite a while before the baby is actually attempting to walk, somewhere between 1 and 2 years, between 1 and 2 years, before the human infant actually is walking, is making an attempt to walk. And then, you know, it can be months before the child is walking really efficiently and not constantly falling. And the baby's first attempts to walk are mostly failures. But everybody is very happy. You know, the parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, the older siblings, the village. You know, your baby just stands up without falling over for 3 seconds, and there's videos you pass around to all your friends. The baby takes 2 or 3 steps before they fall, and everybody there, but again, everybody is celebrating. So in the same way, in bhakti yoga, one experiences some genuine taste, some genuine rasa with Krishna that allows one to then see the material rasa as a reflection, as a perverted reflection. And the Lord and all of the acharyas, they all celebrate. They all are joyful. And they're not very concerned that the sadhaka who's trying to walk stumbles. It's not really their concern. Their concern is on the walking. And such should be our concern too. Not that we shouldn't be a pretender and we shouldn't sin on the strength of chanting. But what we should focus on is our times where we really do experience that fullness, where we really do experience that connection with Krishna, where our attraction to things of this world becomes not some mechanical endeavor, but just laughable. It just becomes insignificant. And we've all experienced this, even if we're not perfectly experiencing this with everything. We all experience it with something. You know, those of us who used to be meat eaters, you know, our interest in eating meat is, I would assume, nothing. It's just flat. It doesn't require some endeavor on our part in order to avoid eating meat. It just that we have no interest in it whatsoever. You know, and one may walk through a grocery store where they have, you know, things that made from meat or things made from eggs or whatever, and some desire may enter the body. Oh, that looks good, but it has no standing. We don't even, practically speaking, take notice of such a thing. It dissipates almost instantly. The river going to the ocean, it has no stance. And more and more and more, one should experience this in bhakti. You know, we should see that we're making progress. Yes, we may fall, we may slip, we may stumble. You know, little children get bruises all the time from falling. I remember one of our children, when he was first learning how to walk, would bump into things all the time. It's like he had perpetual bruises on his forehead from bumping into things. So, you know, we may fall, we may stumble, we may bruise, we may bump into things. But the child and the family celebrate the successes. So we should celebrate the successes and see where and how do I really feel full? What are the services, what are the angas of bhakti that really fill me with fullness? Where I feel so connected with Krishna and Guru, where I feel this rasa, and where in that state nothing in the world holds any attraction for me. It just is not interesting. And whatever thoughts and feelings and desires are present in my body and mind, just I practically don't notice them. They practically just come and go on their own as I'm absorbed in service. And we should do more and more and more of those kinds of services. And then every once in a while we may look back and say, oh wow, I have no attraction to that thing anymore. That thing that pulled me, that thing that was so glittering to me, it's no longer of interest. And that should be our symptoms of advancement. So, question, I've gone late today, sorry about that. But I could take one or two maybe, if anybody has questions or comments.
Oh, all right. I'm sorry, my screen just changed. Just give me a second to get back.
Somebody has a hand up. I think that's you, Ramananda, has a hand up.
Yeah, I do, but I'm trying to open this up. What is going on? Oh, sorry.
Okay.
I can't believe it. I'm not able to figure this out. But anyway, I'll ask my question since I muted everybody else. sorry, I'll figure it out. We know the problem with sense gratification is that, you know, if you have some wonderful sense gratification, you eat your cake or whatever, it doesn't last. You have to experience it again and again and again, and then it loses its... You have to do something more and more, you know, to get that same level of enjoyment. We know the problem.
Yes.
Now, with spiritual life, sometimes Krishna really can bless us with some sort of deep realization or some spiritual experience like that. So those are some skaras, you know, that keep us going. However, also spiritual realization or some sort of, you know, mercy that comes, that also can wane because our memory, you know, doesn't last. It's not like the same experience that we had when that intense experience happened. So,
that what you're describing is anista sadhana bhakti. So, unsteady bhakti. So, unsteady bhakti simply means that there's too many anarthas. That's just all it means. There's too much other stuff crowding out the bhakti. And as those anarthas become removed, then the bhakti becomes steadier and steadier, and one's experience becomes steadier and steadier. And there's not any way... I mean, we get asked this so many times all over the world. You know, how can I become steady? And the only way to become steady is to let go of anarthas. Now, in the beginning, anarthas are meat-eating, illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, you know, bad association. And as we progress, the anarthas become more subtle. And we become less and less and less inclined to give them up. So you can see people get stuck in unsteady sadhana bhakti for a long time, which is not a very satisfying place to be. It really isn't. You know, it's where a person is mostly giving up the illusory sense gratification, but they're not steadily experiencing spiritual bliss. And because we're pleasure-seeking by nature, it's not a very good place to stay. So this means to be willing to give up the subtle anarthas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we fight that like crazy. I mean, I can see that in myself, and I also see that in counseling thousands of devotees. You know, and I'm sure we all have this experience. Somebody will ask us, you know, what can I do to progress? And they talk to us for a while, we look at their life, and we see it plain as day. And we're just like, yeah, this is it. This is the thing that you need to do or you need to not do. Sometimes it's the thing they need to do and sometimes it's the thing they need to not do. And they'll argue with us. And they'll fight it. They'll tell us that we're wrong, or they'll tell us why they have to keep not doing it, or why they have to keep doing it, or what will happen if they do that, or what will happen if they don't do that. And so they're just holding on tight to this anartha. And that's...
Yeah, I get it, everybody, finally.
Oh, there you go. So that's the problem. And eventually, if we chant attentively, and if we worship the deity attentively, and we take prasadam attentively, eventually we are willing to let go of these subtle anarthas. You know, lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, madness, desire for fame and all that kind of thing. And then we get that steady taste. But you just can't get...
So steady taste comes when the anarthas are disputed.
Yes. And there's no shortcut. You know, you can't get a steady taste and hold on to your anarthas. It just doesn't work. So, you know, that's the problem. And to some extent, we have to be patient with ourselves, that to some extent, we have to be patient, that as long as I'm unwilling to let go of these anarthas, my taste is going to be unsteady. That just, it just is what it is. And then the other hand, it's a willingness to really cultivate a willingness to let go of anarthas. You know, and the more one does that, the easier it is to do it, because you see how nice it is. Yes, Narahari.
Thank you very much for your class. Would you mind going over again the difference between karma yoga and bhakti yoga?
So in karma yoga, the mood is generally God as the universal form, as the virat rupa. And the mood is that I am a something, I am a label. You don't give up the upadhi. Like in bhakti, it's sarva padhi vinirmuktam. It starts with that. In karma yoga, you don't give up your upadhi. You keep your upadhi. You're just doing it for another purpose. Now, eventually, if you do karma yoga correctly, you will let go of your upadhi. At the ultimate end of karma yoga, you will lose that. You will come to realize that you are a soul. But the process of karma yoga, you're still holding on to that upadhi. And that's the danger of karma yoga. The danger of karma yoga is that, you know, you don't progress. You get swept up by the upadhi again, and you get pulled back into karmakanda instead of karma yoga. This was the danger of the hornets that Mahaprabhu tells Sanatana Goswami. We explained this in our Essence Seekers book. You know, and the danger of gyan, Mahaprabhu talks about as the yaksha. The danger of gyan is that you get into being a philosopher and you lose sight that I'm a soul. And you get swept away by your ability to philosophize. And the danger of dhyan yoga is that you identify with the supersoul and you try to merge with the supersoul, which Mahaprabhu compares to a snake, the kundalini snake. Now, there's also a danger in bhakti yoga, by the way. Bhakti yoga is not free of a danger. The danger in bhakti yoga is your crazy elephant, the elephant in must. And the danger in bhakti yoga is thinking that you're better than others, or your form of devotion is better than others, and therefore being offensive to other spiritual practitioners. Because bhakti yoga is a better process than others. And so therefore the downside is thinking, because I'm in a better process, therefore I am better. And criticizing others. So each of them has their bugaboo, but in karma yoga, their trap door. But in karma yoga, the main difference between the karma yogi and the bhakti yogi is the bhakti yogi starts out without the upadhi, The bhakti yogi is, I am a soul. I have a body and mind that has the nature of a grihastha kshatriya. So I'm going to do that for the pleasure of Bhagavan Sri Krishna. But I'm never a grihastha kshatriya or a sannyasi or whatever. Whereas in karma yoga, it's I am a grihastha kshatriya. And I am doing this as my proper place in the universe for my purification and liberation. So the mood is different.
Hmm. And where do the fruits go? So the karma yogi, he keeps the fruit, the bhakti yoga offers
you? No. If you're keeping the fruit, you're a karma kandi. To be a karma yogi, you're giving the fruit. You're giving the fruits to the universe. Just like the cells in your body, they're giving their fruits to you. So I'm working for the benefit of the universal body for my purification. And my enjoyment in karma yoga is the health of the universal body rather than my own direct enjoyment.
And when you say that he gives it to the universe, he doesn't give it to Krishna or God.
Yes, but God in terms of the universe and in terms of my upadi. So it's still a kind of yoga because the universe is still a form of God.
Got it.
Karma yogis have a hard time getting liberated. If they're just in karma yoga, they have a hard time getting liberated. Because they don't give up their upadi. So for a karma yogi to get liberated, they'd have to come to a point where they actually see that they're a soul. That's possible. It's not impossible. But generally, they're going to do that by adopting some of the higher forms of yoga. So they would generally do that by moving up to Gyan yoga or moving up to Dhyan yoga. Or moving up to Bhakti yoga, not just staying in karma yoga. Just staying in karma yoga, it's hard.
Thank you very much.
Sure. All right, it has gotten late, and so I think we should end now. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Thank you. Hari Bol.